No British general of the Revolutionary War has been written about more than John Burgoyne. That's because he led British troops at the Battle of Saratoga in New York in 1777, and the British loss is widely seen as the turning point in the Revolutionary War. He was also considered a reckless playboy, and there's plenty in his life story to support this characterization. He gambled heavily, and some think he had to flee England as a young man to escape his debtors. But he was eventually able to secure a commission in the Seven Years' War, served heroically, and became a celebrity. But there's a whole lot more to John Burgoyne. He was a satirical London playwright, a reformer member of Parliament, he called out the corruption of the East India Company, and throughout his life, he was a gambler in the clubs on St. James Street. Today's guest is Norman Poser, author of the book, From the Battlefield to the Stage, The Many Lies of General John Burgoyne. We not only look at the Saratoga campaign, but also elements of Burgoyne's life that have never been adequately explored, including the four children that he had out of wedlock with actress and singer Susan Caulfield. He was a very colorful character, and although his name is well known, it's definitely a worthwhile excursus to look into these unknown parts of his life. Hope you enjoyed this discussion with Norman Poser. And one more thing before we get started with this episode, a quick break for a word from our sponsors.
Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on multiple systems, on delivering your product or service, the more margin you have and the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR into one platform with one source of truth. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required, accessed from anywhere. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite. And you're improving efficiency by bringing all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move. So do the math. See how you'll profit with NetSuite.
Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/stereo. netsuite.com/stereo.
The first and usually only thing that people know about John Burgoyne is that he's responsible for Britain's loss at the Battle of Saratoga, which could very well have made him responsible for losing the Revolutionary War. Now, I know a little bit more about him, that he had a bon vivant lifestyle. He loved to gamble. He was involved in the theater, carried on liaison with at least one actress. But let's begin with the part of his life that people are the most familiar with, and that's the Battle of Saratoga. There's been a long argument about how responsible Burgoyne was. Maybe he was responsible. Maybe General Howe was responsible for not giving him reinforcements. Maybe Benedict Arnold and his bravery was responsible. How responsible do you think Burgoyne is for the loss at the Battle of Saratoga for Britain?
Well, I think that there's enough blame to go around. And I don't think any one person was responsible. I think that Burgoyne has to share some of the responsibility. I think that in two different ways. One is that he took on this job and he really didn't have enough experience to be the general of an army to go through in the wilderness, coming from Canada into New York and fight the Americans. His only battle experience was very, very different. It was as a colonel in Portugal, where he led a group of a couple of thousand men on a daring expedition. He gained a wonderful reputation for bravery. But here he was really, he had taken on more than he could handle. He had two things. One is that he didn't pay enough attention to logistics. His army was hungry 2 weeks after he went into New York State. And the second thing is that he didn't behave like a general. He behaved like a colonel. He was in the middle of the fighting in Saratoga. His opponent, Horatio Gates, the American general, was a mile or two behind the lines, and people were reporting to him, and he could see the whole battle and make decisions. Burgoyne, showing huge bravery, was right in the middle of the battle and wasn't in a position to understand everything that was going on. I should also mention that, yes, as you mentioned, Howe was very much responsible, for he acted as if Burgoyne wasn't even there and decided, instead of meeting in Albany as the plan called for and had been approved by the king, he decided to go down to Philadelphia. And to make matters worse, he took his army by ship, so that there was really nothing between the Americans and Burgoyne, and they could concentrate all of their forces on him, and he was, you know, vastly undermanned when he was involved in, when he was at Saratoga. And then the other person was Germain, Lord George Germain, who in London, who's a minister for the colonies, who was in charge of the actions in the colony in America. And he allowed these two major armies in North America to be out of touch with each other, not be able to communicate. Neither one knew what the other was doing necessarily. And his handling of the war was not good, to say the least, and he has to bear some of the responsibility.
This is interesting for me because I did a series with a co-host, James Early, years ago on battles of the Revolutionary War, and briefly looked at Burgoyne's life, his playboy lifestyle, and how he was loved by his men. They nicknamed him Gentleman Johnny, but he seemed like a, to me at least, a cad who purchased his officership and then was thrust into battle, perhaps unprepared for it, lost the battle. This is a turning point of the war. France sees that the Americans are actually an effective fighting force. They join on their side. Rest is history. And then Burgoyne, at the end of his life, he goes back. He is involved in theater and seems like a cad or a dandy. But as we'll see, there's much more to his story. So this is why I love to fill in the blanks here in my knowledge. Let's go back to his early life. And he is not a noble. He comes from a military background, but he only achieves these elite connections later. Can you tell me about his early life and his marriage into a wealthy family?
Well, yes, although a lot of that is unclear. But apparently, he got to know the son of the Earl of Derby, who was called Lord Strange, and they became friends. Some of the books say that they became close friends at Westminster School. That's perhaps a little unlikely, because Strange was about 6 years older than Burgoyne. And so when they were kids, it's unlikely they became close friends, but they did later on. And as a result, he was invited to the home, the Knowsley Hall, up near Liverpool in England, and met the youngest daughter of the Earl. And they fell in love. And clearly the Earl was against the marriage. And so they eloped, maybe the first reckless thing he did. Soon after that, the couple went to France, and they lived in France and Italy for 5 or 6 years. Why they went isn't totally clear. And some say that he got himself into such debt that he had to leave in order to avoid debtor's prison. It may be the case, but there's no evidence that it was. It's circumstantial. And another possibility is that he wanted to go to Europe to complete his education, and the idea of he had had no formal education except when he was preteen, maybe up to about from 10 to 15 years old at Westminster School, and it was considered very much in the interest of a man with ambitions to go to Europe for a while and become the grand tour, if you like. And he did take advantage of that by learning French, which was the international language that was used at the time. And they made a lot of contacts there, particularly a man named the Duke of Choiseul, who ended up being the foreign minister of France. That was a friendship that lasted the rest of his life, even though the two countries were at war part of the time. But then when it looked like war was going to begin in 1756, the Seven Years' War, he hurried back to England because he had resigned his commission, but he went back into the army and gained a reputation for skill and bravery and leadership. first as a captain and later on as a colonel in the army.
This opportunity to marry Charlotte Stanley, it really helped his social status because, as you note in your book, that in the 18th century, Britain was essentially controlled by an oligarchy of about 200 different families. And moving up the social ladder, whether through politics or the military, would be incredibly difficult without some sort of connection among this cohort, which he was able to gain. There's an aspect of Burgoyne's personality I would like to explore. On the one hand, he's able to placate the worries of Lord Stanley that his daughter marries someone not of her social rank by his impeccable manners. On the other hand, he loves gambling. He loves going to Brooks Club on St. James Street. Can you tell me about these two aspects of his character?
Well, yeah, he was a gambler. And I believe that one of the things that he developed in France, particularly, was a skill at playing cards. So, yes, that was just one aspect of his personality, that he liked to gamble and he liked to socialize. And he did at Brooks's Club. He was also a member of White's Club, which is across the street, which the Whigs liked to go to Brooks's and the Tories went to White's. But the one thing I'd like to say about the marriage, you could imagine that eloping with a daughter of the wealthy, rich, influential Earl of Derby was sort of a cynical act, but it wasn't. They had a very, very fine marriage until she died in 1776. But it was a companionable, happy marriage from what we know. And what we do know is that Burgoyne wrote about it. He wrote to his wife. I think they were both in love. And the Earl, within a short time after the marriage, it's not clear exactly when, took Burgoyne into his family. And of course, he probably could not have become a general in the army without that, because as you said, he was not a nobleman himself.
Particularly afterwards, what sort of proves his character is his experiences in the Seven Years' War. Can you tell us about his commanding of the cavalry regiment in Portugal and everything that happens there?
Well, Portugal was historically a British ally, and Britain had very, very strong commercial interests there, particularly in wine, port wine. Spain was an ally of France, and Burgoyne's friend, the Duc de Choiseul, was then by that time foreign minister, and he encouraged Spain to attack Portugal. And Portugal was very poor and it was a very poor country. The Portuguese government appointed a German officer who had been trained in England. He was a German count, to be the commander of the army. And the English sent several thousand troops, Irish and English troops, to Portugal under his command. Burgoyne was subordinate of the count, the commander, and the commander told Burgoyne to make a raid on a town that was right just inside the Spanish border. It really wasn't all that important. It was to create a diversion that would maybe prevent the Spanish from taking another town, Almeida. Well, Burgoyne showed his audacity, his bravery, his leadership in a lightning raid on this town. It was not in the war. It was not really important. And the war ended, the Seven Years' War ended, including the campaign in Spain and Portugal, ended very shortly after that. We're talking about 1762, I believe. But Burgoyne came home a hero, and the King of Portugal gave him a very valuable jewel and the standards that they'd captured in the battle. And so this was a tremendous boost in Burgoyne's career. He had accomplished that. And there was another battle, too, where he did not personally involve, but he told a subordinate of his, a man named Lee, who later became a general in the American army in the Revolutionary War, to do a somewhat similar raid on a camp of the Spanish, and that was very successful too.
Hey everyone, Scott here. We're going to take a short break for a word from our sponsors.
Today's podcast is brought to you by Newspapers.com, your portal to the past. If you're like me and can't get enough of untold stories and forgotten tales, you're in for a treat. Newspapers.com has nearly a billion pages of historical newspapers dating back to the 1690s, and you can search them all in seconds. It's a treasure trove waiting for curious minds like yours. And with papers from across the US, UK, Canada, Australia, and beyond, Newspapers.com is the ultimate resource to unearth the stories that shaped our world. And here's something special for our history-loving listeners. Newspapers.com is offering an exclusive discount. Use the code HISTORYUNPLUGGED and get 20% off your subscription. That's promo code HISTORYUNPLUGGED, one word, at Newspapers.com. It's like having your own time machine to explore the stories that made history come alive. One more time, HISTORYUNPLUGGED, promo code at Newspapers.com.
Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on multiple systems, on delivering your product or service, the more margin you have and the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR into one platform with one source of truth. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required, accessed from anywhere. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite. And you're improving efficiency by bringing all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move. So do the math. See how you'll profit with NetSuite.
Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/stereo. netsuite.com/stereo.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
We'll come back to his pre-Revolutionary War life because there are important parts of his career, but I want to briefly jump to the period after the Battle of Saratoga because this relates to his military experiences. As we noted earlier, he was incredibly popular with his men. He fought alongside them. And there's something that he does after the Battle of Saratoga when he's a prisoner of war, where he petitions the Continental Army for the mistreatment of one of his men. Could you mention this? Because I think this says a lot about how he's able to gain so much respect of those who serve under him.
Yes, yes. Earlier when he became the colonel of a regiment, he had written, he didn't call them instructions, but they were his ideas about how to handle and treat men, and they were very forward-looking. He did not like flogging. He may have flogged somebody, he may have ordered flogging sometimes, but generally speaking, it was widely used punishment. He did not like it. He liked more of psychological treatment of his men, that every man should be treated as a human being. And my theory is that he got that from his headmaster at Westminster School when he was a young child. This was a really an extraordinary event where a colonel, this was when the troop, his captive army was in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and being treated terribly. A colonel, an American colonel, ordered one of his men to bayonet one of the, because he was rude or something, or drunk, one of the British prisoners. And when the man would not do it, he actually attacked him and wounded him. Burgoyne asked the commander there, the American general, that this colonel should be court-martialed. And the colonel agreed. And Burgoyne said that he personally was going to prosecute the man. And it was kind of surprising that he acted very much as a lawyer. He called witnesses. He took testimony. He made a opening speech, made a closing speech to the American officers who were sitting as a court-martial on this other American officer. As it turned out, the officer was acquitted, which is on the grounds that there wasn't enough evidence. It was more or less predictable that they would, and spirits ran high. The British were not liked by the citizens of Cambridge or by their captors because, to some extent, they were rather arrogant. But it seemed to me that what he was doing was putting into practice in a very, very real crisis situation his belief that he is loyalty to his men. And I think it was a very telling episode.
This shows his, perhaps we could say, modern views on military discipline. You can also see this streak in his political career as a reformer. Can you discuss his experiences as an MP before and after the war?
Yes. He became an MP in the early 60s, a fellow officer who owned a borough. You know, this was in a time of England when if you had enough money, you could buy a borough and then make sure the tenants voted the way you wanted them to. He bought a borough, but that man got killed in the Belle Isle campaign, which I described in the book. It was an island off the coast of France, which the British attacked and captured during the Seven Years' War. And he then ran to be an MP in the town of Preston, where there was a genuine campaign, a real election campaign between the Whigs and the Tories. It was a very violent campaign, and Burgoyne won it. And so it could be regarded in a way as one of the early real elections in England. But he won it, he had to pay a fine of £1,000, which is a lot of money at the time, because for inciting violence there. He walked down the main street of the town with two pistols in his hand and a bunch of his soldiers supporting him, sort of like what's it goes on these days. And so he then that began his real career as a member of parliament. He was always supported the rule of law. He was against corruption. There was a man in England named Robert Clive. I grew up in England, and I remember learning about him as one of the builders of the British Empire. He was that, but he was also corrupt in taking bribes, and some of them forced from Indian. This was in the context of the East India Company, which basically was a government of its own in India, ruled at least large parts of India. And he tried to convict Clive of corruption, but the government supported Clive, and so that didn't work out. But he was always of a reforming nature. And some of that reform spirit of his came out in some of the plays he wrote.
Which I'd like to explore, because that's also another part of his career in addition to MP, officer, and now playwright. So could you talk about his experiences there and the social commentary of his plays?
Well, at first, he had been writing stuff. He loved to write poetry. I would call it light verse. Most of it was sort of romantic and sexual. It was he wrote some very nice stuff. It was very, very, some of it I quote in the book. But the first play he wrote, he may have written a play actually when he was in America in 1774, but I think the first play he wrote is called The Maid of the Oaks, and it was done to be played at a garden party. Very, very big affair, which the Darbys paid for, but he was the manager of it. And I think that some of his knowledge about entertainment came from his days in France, because they called it a fête de campagne, a country play, a country party, rather. And that play was later on expanded into a five-act play and performed at Drury Lane Theatre, one of the two major theaters in London. And it was a letter that he wrote to David Garrick, the manager of Drury Lane, that got me originally interested in writing a biography because it was such an unusual letter, particularly for a general to have written, and in which he said, Burgoyne said, that he didn't want any money for, he didn't want any part of the proceeds that the author would normally get, but he wanted them to go to a fund that Garrick had set up as for the old retired actors and their families. And he didn't want that fact, his generosity, made public unless it in some way would help the financial work of the play. That was the first play he wrote, and that was before he went to America. When he came back, and that's a whole other story, and came back in 1778, he was pretty much at first not in good graces of the government. They wanted to send him back to America, but he didn't go, and he began writing plays. And that period of his life is really his last decade. The 1780s was the last decade of his life. He was very much involved with the theater, and he wrote three more plays. One of them, called The Heiress, was quite a success, actually. It was actually translated into other languages and played in cities in Ireland and also in other countries in continental Europe.
A note about getting the sources for his life. You note in the opening of your book that this letter, written in 1774, where he's trying to send the profits of his play to a charity, this was an unpublished letter, and there is a significant amount about his life that has to do with anything related to Saratoga. But what happens before and what happens afterwards is much more scattershot. Could you mention the lack of sources in his life and perhaps the reasons why this is so, particularly in the last decade of his life?
Well, it may well be. Well, let me put it this way. This was a great period for letter writing. After all, that was how people communicated. And Burgoyne, who loved to write, he wrote, you know, as I said, he wrote poetry, he wrote plays. He must have got and he must have written and received many letters, but very, very few are extant today. I'm talking about personal letters. We know what his letters to Germain during the Saratoga campaign, they were in the line of duty. But so we think, I think, and at least one other of his earlier biographers think that his descendants, probably his granddaughters, destroyed the letters. That's why it's so difficult to put together a lot of things. After his wife died, he got to know this woman who was almost certainly an actress and a singer. And during the 1780s, he probably met her about 1780, and they were together for 12 years until he died in 1792. She bore four children to him. He and his wife had had one child, a girl, but she died at the age of 10. She was born in France during their self-imposed exile in France. She was born in Aix-en-Provence in France, but at 10 years old in England, she died. So he had no children by his wife Charlotte, but he did have four children by Susan Caulfield. The frustrating thing in writing about this is that there's next to no information available about her. It seems that after he died, these children were still young children. The grandson of the Earl of Derby, who then was himself the Earl of Derby, supported those children and helped. There was a boy and three girls, and that he helped the boy to have a military career and himself ended up as not just a general, but a field marshal.
Scott here. One more break for a word from our sponsors.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes.
Chumba. ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper? A woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver. I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses. So don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
What do we know about this period and his relationship with Susan Caulfield, who was the actress and singer with whom he had four children?
Well, there's very little we know. Other biographers have felt free to invent things about her, but basically there's nothing. The only thing we know for sure is that he wrote a letter to her, very affectionate, a very short letter, but my dearest Sue, he wrote. And he refers in a way to her singing, which that supports the idea that she was a singer. But there's basically, that's about all we know. But in his will, he left money to her. The problem was he didn't have much money himself, and I don't know that she ever got it. The Earl of Derby, as I said, took over the support of the four children. So she, and what I'm guessing, but we don't know that for sure, is that she gave up her support of them because she couldn't support them and enabled them to have a genteel upper class life, which she couldn't have given them.
Overall, what would you say is the legacy of John Burgoyne? You know in your book that there's much more to him than the general responsible for losing Saratoga. That point, as we said, is arguable, but he had many careers. He was a reformer. He fought for the rule of law and fought corruption in the East India Company. He was a playwright. Putting these different strands together, what would you say is his legacy?
I think that the most important thing that I got out of that was his basic decency. Yes, he had faults. As you said, he used the system of nepotism to the utmost that he could. He could be very reckless and even violent. He was very proud if somebody gave him anything that he thought was an insult or not even an insult, but he would just turn away. There's some wonderful anecdotes, which I've described in the book, of his behavior in that way. But he was a decent man, and he was talented. He was versatile. He was humane. And I think that the reason that there's been more interest in him than in many generals who won a lot of battles, and all we know about him is the major battle he lost, is that he's such an attractive character. And I think the characterization of him as sort of lightweight is totally wrong. He had great intelligence, although he had not too much formal education. He apparently picked up a lot because when I read some of the things he wrote, for example, in battle reports back to England, in some of the things he said as a member of Parliament, show that he had retained from his school days a knowledge of Latin classics, and he was a very fine person. And he had, you know, I think maybe you mentioned at the beginning that there was the he got this nickname of the Gentleman Johnny, and that was created not in his own life, but 100 years later, George Bernard Shaw, in a play called The Devil's Disciple, gave him that name, that nickname. And when some of the other biographers have said that, as a matter of fact, Shaw thought of, before he came on the name of Gentleman Johnny, he thought of calling him Frosty Fred, which doesn't make, I'm glad he gave up that idea. But yes, he comes across alive as an extremely, a man who led an exciting life and a man who was, I think his obituary who said he didn't leave much in money, but he left a wonderful reputation in that he had as a wonderful man. That's how I see him. Maybe I shouldn't fall in love with my biography, but I think it's fair to say that his legacy is of a human and humane man.
Well, I always enjoy learning more about people whose lives I see in passing, but they have enough interesting about them that I wish I could circle back, and this is a great chance to do so. For listeners who want to look at the story even more closely, the name of Norman's book is From the Battlefield to the Stage, The Many Lives of General John Burgoyne. Norman, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
All right, that is all for today. If you'd like to see show notes for this episode and all my other episodes, go to ParthenonPodcast.com. That's the name of the podcast network that this show is a part of, along with other great history shows like Steve Guerra's Beyond the Big Screen and History of the Papacy, James Early's Key Battles of American History, and other shows as well. If you'd like to support this show, there are two easy ways to do so. The first is to subscribe to History Unplugged on the podcast player of your choice and leave a review. The second thing is to join the show's membership program. It's on Patreon, and if you go to patreon.com/unplugged and join it, as a member, you'll get completely ad-free episodes of the show's entire back catalog, which is 600 episodes and growing. Just go to patreon.com/unplugged. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you next time.
War has played a key role in the history of the United States, from the nation's founding right down to the present. Wars made the United States independent, kept it together, increased its size, and established it as a global superpower. Hi, I'm James Early, host of the Key Battles of American History podcast. In each episode, I discuss American history through the lens of the most important battles of America's wars. To start listening now, go to ParthenonPodcast.com or search Key Battles of American History on your favorite podcasting platform.